We're going to call the Rules Committee to order today. And today we're going to start by a bill that we carried over from last meeting, and that is HJR 23. So we're going to open a public hearing on HJR 23. And with that, we'll have Representative Garrett come up, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. HJR 23 proposes a constitutional amendment to modify the scope of initiative amendments to the Constitution, prohibits initiative amendments to the Constitution from dedicating revenues, making or repealing appropriations, or otherwise limiting the ability of the legislative assembly to raise revenues. In 2002, National Conference of State Legislatures published a report showing that of the 24 states using the initiative process, only seven had no restrictions other than a single subject limitation on the subject matter of initiative proposals. Oregon is one of those states. The remaining 16 states impose a variety of restrictions on initiative proposals, including restrictions on the ability of initiatives to affect revenues and expenditures. At least one state, Florida, specifically prohibits limitations on the power of government to raise revenues. Alaska prohibits use of the initiative to, quote, dedicate revenues, make or repeal appropriations, end quote. Some proponents of restricting initiative impacts on revenues and expenditures assert that the lack of such restrictions adversely affects Oregon's bond ratings.
Thank you very much. So with that, welcome Representative Garrett.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, Chris Garrett, State Representative from House District 38. Thanks for having me back here at the tail end of Initiative Reform Week here in the Rules Committee. And I appreciate the courtesy of hearing HJR 23, sponsored by myself and a few other state legislators this session. HJR 23, I've submitted written testimony on this bill, and I won't go into that at any length. I know we're on a tight agenda here. I'd just like to spend 1 or 2 minutes on an overview of why I've brought this resolution to you. This resolution is really about the relationship between direct democracy and representative government, which is not a new question. It takes us back to the formation of our country and debates that surrounded the adoption of our federal constitution in 1787. HJR 23 would restrict the subject matter of initiatives that propose to amend our state constitution. It would say that ballot measures can't amend the constitution to dedicate revenues or impair the legislature's ability to raise revenue. The initiative process would survive under this resolution. People could continue to amend the Constitution, and they could continue to pass statutory initiatives that dedicate revenue or reduce taxes. They simply couldn't enact constitutional amendments that do that. Why is the budget special? Why should we carve the budget out of the scope of permissible constitutional amendments? My written testimony describes some of the effects of the unfettered use of the initiative process to set Oregon's fiscal policy. Oregon is constitutionally required, like other states, to operate a balanced budget. Oregon is virtually alone, however, in allowing unrestricted use of ballot measures to unbalance the budget by way of constitutional amendments that increase spending, cut revenues, and place those actions beyond the reach of the body, the legislature, charged with maintaining a balanced budget. The resulting unpredictability is inherently destabilizing and has been cited by bond rating agencies, as the administrator noted, as a reason to lower Oregon's credit rating, making it more costly for us to borrow money and finance public projects. We were the second state to adopt the initiative process. Many other states followed, but almost none of them went as far as we did. Some allow initiatives to amend the Constitution. Others allow statutory initiatives to affect revenues and spending. Almost none, however, allow the combination of the two, and we are a very good lesson why that's the case. Budgeting is about balancing revenues and expenditures and setting priorities. Ultimately, budgeting is about nothing other than that. Using ballot measures to enshrine budget choices in the Constitution inherently conflicts with the requirement of operating a balanced budget because ballot measures require no discipline or accountability. That is why it is constitutionally essential that the budgeting process remain under the exclusive control of the institution that's charged with maintaining the balanced budget. I could spend another hour on the constitutional theory of Republican government, but I'd like to be invited back sometime, and I recognize it's Friday afternoon with the full agenda. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions for this witness? Seeing none.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Jessen Black and Dan Meek.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Justin Black. I'm from the Oregon Education Association. We represent roughly 48,000 members who work in the education fields, all the way from kindergarten to community college and everywhere in between. I come today to give our support for this House resolution. You know, I think our members have lived under the initiative system and been borne the brunt of a lot of blows through the initiative system, like about Measure 5 and a number of other initiatives. And I'm going to be brief, but I want to touch on one fact. You know, I think one of the biggest problems with doing expenditures through the Constitution is that priorities that we have now are not necessarily the priorities we're going to have in 20 years, nor are the priorities we had 20 years our priorities now. And when you put expenditures and taxation in the Constitution, it makes it much harder for you guys to change and makes it much harder for the people of Oregon to change as times change. You know, we feel that the debate over fiscal priorities is a good one. You know, what is a priority today may not be a priority tomorrow, and that every year you guys should debate, you know, what you all spend money on and what taxpayers spend money on. It's the only way for taxpayers to change their mind and for the public to change their mind. So I would be that brief and close, and that's it.
Thank you very much. Dan.
My name is Dan Meek. I have worked with many groups that have put measures on the ballot and opposed measures on the ballot since 1978. I would oppose House Joint Resolution 23. I think the first thing to note is that it seems to be the opposite of several other bills that have been proposed in this session, some of them by the same co-sponsors. What this states is that an initiative amendment to the Constitution may not dedicate revenues, make or repeal appropriations, or otherwise limit the legislative assembly's ability to raise revenue. The first clause there says an initiated amendment, can't dedicate revenues. This, to me, seems to be the opposite of other bills that are before you, and in particular House Joint Resolution 28, that requires that an initiative identify the source of funding for the initiative. Also, House Bill 2845 requires that if an initiative comes through and it requires money, you have to specify the source of funding. That's called dedicating revenues. So this amendment would prohibit the sorts of changes that are required by HJR 28 and House Bill 2845. Note that it also would not allow an initiative amendment to make or repeal appropriations. Well, let's imagine an amendment that establishes a nonpartisan commission to adopt and enforce limits on political contributions. I'm told that that would have to be a constitutional amendment. Unless the amendment can provide for appropriations, the legislature could simply not appropriate any money, and therefore and there would be no enforcement of the limits. This is not a theoretical possibility. In Massachusetts, the voters overwhelmingly adopted a system through initiative, adopted a system of public funding for elections. But the Massachusetts legislature refused to fund it, refused to do appropriations that were necessary to fund the commission that was to enforce and implement the system. You may recall that there were courts in Massachusetts that then ordered that the furniture of the legislative assembly be seized and sold in order to fund the system. But the legislature then responded by repealing the whole thing, repealing the entire public funding system. So if the legislature is in charge of the money, no matter what the Constitution, you can't dedicate revenues and you can't make appropriations through a constitutional amendment, then any measure like campaign finance reform that the legislature is not inclined to adopt, the legislature can frustrate by not funding. Now, you'll notice that the sponsor of the measure, one of the co-sponsors, said, well, ballot measure folks can still dedicate revenue with statutes. Well, that's true, and the legislature can disregard that and repeal them. So this is a very fundamental change in the balance of power really between the folks using the initiative process and the legislature. In addition, one other thing, The effective date of this proposal, it states that the amendment to Section 1 applies to initiative petitions proposing an amendment to the Constitution that are filed with the Secretary of State for verification of signatures after July 7, 2010. In other words, measures for the 2012 ballot. Those can be drafted and be in the ballot title process now. Gathering of the signatures on those can start in July 2010. But what this measure would do is retroactively change the requirements for the content of those measures long after the measures have already been drafted and gone through the ballot title process. So I think the effective date would need to be pushed off another 2 years in order to not retroactively invalidate measures that are proposed measures that are already in the signature gathering process.
Any questions for these two witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Nolan.
Mr. Meek, I just want to clarify if you can distinguish for me your personal opinion about the difference between statutory and constitutional initiatives, and if you could define the appropriate use or which each of those should appropriately be used to do. How would you distinguish between those two?
Representative Nolan, I would say that a constitutional initiative is sometimes necessary to adopt measures that the legislature is inherently hostile toward, in particular measures that apply the operations of the legislature and in elections themselves in particular, and particularly election campaigns. The purpose of the initiative, I think, is to allow the voters to enact laws and amend the Constitution in ways that the legislature will not abide. And if you essentially eviscerate the amendment process by indicating that the legislature will, in any event, have the ability to withhold funding from anything that might be adopted by a constitutional amendment, then I think you have essentially eliminated the constitutional amendment process.
If I could follow up.
Follow up.
So I actually think this is actually a pretty big distinction. What I'm hearing you say is the Constitution isn't really something to establish the framework for the government and the rights of individuals, but it is something to be used to keep statutes out of grasp of the legislature.
Representative Nolan, not exactly, although keeping statutes, I will tell you that I have had the unpleasant experience of having ballot measures I've worked on that are statutes subsequently repealed by the legislature, in particular ballot measure 9 of 1978. The legislature repealed that effectively in 1999. I then worked with others to gather 70,000 signatures within 90 days to place that repeal on the ballot as ballot measure 90 of the year 2000. I then, of course, as you do in a referendum, you go out and collect the signatures, then you urge a no vote on the measure. We urged the no vote, and we succeeded in getting a no vote of about 88.4%. But in any event, it was the legislature back in 1999, in a measure that is very central to me, felt no qualms about, it was an overwhelming vote, felt no qualms about repealing a measure that voters had overwhelmingly enacted by a vote of 2-1 in 1978. So sometimes it is necessary for people using the initiative process to adopt measures that are beyond the reach of the legislature. In addition, when you talk about the framework of government or the rights of citizens, I described an example that is the framework of government. I would propose a framework of government that has a nonpartisan commission adopting and enforcing limits on political contributions. That is part of the framework of government. But this measure would say, well, you can't assure any funding for that measure, for that commission. That commission would have to come to the legislature to get funded. And then I see this, the Massachusetts scenario played out again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions for either of these? Thank you both. Andy Miller. Is Andy? Oh, I didn't see you back there.
This one, you have the impression that this questions.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Andy Miller from the Oregon Business Association. Our members include businesses of all sizes and industries throughout the state, from our largest farm to two Fortune 500 companies. Our good government committee identified initiative reform as a priority for 2009 session. Our goal is to restore integrity to the initiative process so that it's transparent, accessible, and works as it was originally intended, while protecting it from potential abuses and harmful unintended consequences. Our committee actually had a much broader interpretation of what we would like to do, but it didn't have, as you say, political legs. And that is, we support limiting the constitutional initiatives to matters involving structure, power, and limitations of government, or the rights of people with respect to their government. This HJR 23, prohibiting initiated amendments from dedicated revenues, making or repealing appropriations, or limiting the legislature's ability to raise revenue, is consistent with the previously stated objective, albeit somewhat lighter. I have attached lists of other states which have limitations regarding budget and appropriations, and I did send to your committee administrator the entire slideshow from which this handout came, so you could take a look at that. While this concept would be new to Oregon, it has been tested in other states, and also there you go, attached. We urge you to consider the concepts in HJR 23. And I'm not a lawyer, so I don't go through the bills with a fine-tooth comb, nor do I have my own office in the room. So I can't quite get to our previous testifiers' level of specificity about the bill. But the heart of the bill is budgeting should not be done by the people when the legislature is held responsible for a balanced budget. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public here who would like to speak to HJR 23? That was all that were on our list. Seeing none, we will close our public hearing on HJR 23, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 75A. And we'll have a short explanation again. And
thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 75A establishes procedures for the governor to voluntarily transfer duties of his office to an acting governor when the governor expects to be temporarily unable to discharge duties of the office. It establishes a 5-member disability evaluation panel, establishes qualifications of and procedures for designating panel members, requires disability evaluation panel to be convoked upon written request of at least two specified state officials, and establishes procedures for the disability evaluation panel to find that the governor is unable to discharge the duties of office or is able to resume duties of the office. It repeals current statutes on the disability of the governor.
We heard testimony a couple weeks ago. I have not heard from anyone in regard to this bill. I think it's one that we need to move. If there's any questions, we'll hear a motion from the...
We're on Senate Bill 75.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 75A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards has moved Senate Bill 75A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? We'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Having received the constitutional majority, I declare it passed. Who would like to carry this bill, if anyone? Representative Girard. Okay. So we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 75A, and I do want to make an announcement. Senate Bill 323A, electronic report submission to the legislature. We have an amendment that hasn't gotten here. This is a bill that talks about electronic reporting, and it also talks about making five of these large books that we send out to people. In checking with the different majority and other offices, it's our understanding they don't want the books, so they'd like to cut it down to one copy. So we're going to change it from five to one, and that will save some money for everyone, and we're waiting for that amendment. They will still have a hard copy in the library, but I think it's a reasonable thing to consider after having checked that out. So we haven't got that amendment yet. It should be coming fairly quickly, and then we'll bring this bill back. And with that, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2095. And we have already had what we'll put in a moment, put the motion on the floor. We have an amendment, so we have to first. Oh, you want to? But we'll talk about it. No, we don't. We'll talk about that afterwards. Just do the amendment, too.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments into House Bill 2095.
Representative Evers moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2095, and now we'll have a little discussion on what those amendments are. So, with that, an explanation of the amendments.
All right. Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, the dash two amendment to House Bill 2095 changes the term of office for the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries elected in November 2012 from 4 years to 2 years with the intent of restoring the historical alternating cycle of statewide offices up for election at each general election.
Now we can have a discussion about that amendment, if there's anyone that wants to have a discussion. Any discussion? Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your attention to this. I think this achieves the objective that the administrator mentioned, and I think it's an elegant solution.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, any objection to this amendment? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2095 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Evers moves House Bill 2095 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. House Bill 2095, as amended, dash two, is passed. Dash one and two is passed. Carrier. This is one of those interesting bills with lots of information on it.
That's why I volunteered for the
He saw this one coming.
That's a
smart man.
That's a savvy.
I will carry this bill. And I'll work with the Secretary of State's office so I have a reasonable understanding of all the little intricacies of somebody and have expect someone to be there near me so that they can explain. When we went over this section by section, there was a lot of little things in this bill. So thank you very much. And with that, we will... Very close, on? Yeah, I closed it. Okay. We're going to open a hearing on House Bill 2639. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 2639 allows manufactured dwelling or floating home tenants to place political signs anywhere on the space owned or leased by the tenant. It allows a landlord to establish reasonable rules on size and eliminates the regulation of the placement and character of signs. ORS 90.755 currently provides only that a landlord must allow a tenant to place political signs, quote, on or in, end quote, a manufactured dwelling or floating home owned by the tenant, subject to reasonable regulations of the landlord regarding size, placement, and character of such signs.
With that, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state representative in House District 14, representing West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. I bring you a very simple bill, and it truly is simple. Currently, residents of manufactured home parks do not necessarily have the right to place a political sign in their front yard. They may, by the terms of the park, be allowed to place a political sign in their front window or back window or side window, but not necessarily in the front yard. And it seemed like an issue of equity to me when walking door to door during my previous couple of campaign cycles. I've noticed a number of parks that have political signs placed on the outside boundaries by the owner of the park, but yet the folks that live in the park aren't necessarily allowed to place political signs in their own front yard. So I decided to bring this bill forward, and that's the essence of the bill, and that's the essence of my testimony.
Representative Berger.
Questions.
How happy for you, Representative, that they're pining away to put your political signs everywhere in the mobile home park.
Representative Berger, I have a number of constituents that live in manufactured home parks.
As do I.
36 parks.
Wow.
To be exact.
That is a lot.
So I tend to follow these issues. And I would say that while in many bills there can be a lot of conflict between park owners and tenants, I have found on average to be the tenants of the manufactured home parks in my district very much like and appreciate their park owners. And so I know in a lot of these bills there can be a lot of friction. I did want to be on the record saying the friction in this building over these issues does not necessarily always exist on the ground at home, so between tenants and owners. So.
Okay. Further questions? Seeing none.
That's it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thank Chair. You. And so we have three people. We have three chairs. We might as well bring everybody up. David Jackson, Chuck Carpenter, and Norton Campbell. Make sure that as you address us, that you start by identifying yourself for the record. So we'll start. David.
Good afternoon. My name is David Jackson. I'm a resident of Southwest Portland with a particular interest in promoting the integrity of Oregon elections. I've been involved in the issues surrounding election integrity since the 2000 election, demonstrated the flaws in the U.S. election system for all the world to see. I came here today to address some concerns I have with House Bill 2639 as currently drafted. As a strong advocate for the First Amendment, I applaud the protection to free speech and assembly that are explicitly made in this bill. I might say I've done a lot of campaigning on various issues, and it's important that voters have a right, I think, to display signs and to express their opinions. However, I would also like to point out that Oregon also has prohibition against electioneering in the vicinity of election offices and ballot drop box sites. I would like to see some consideration being given to integrating the protections to free speech and assembly into Oregon's existing laws regarding electioneering. Otherwise, I foresee confusion and possible litigation taking place to clarify this intersection of free speech for political expression and protections against electioneering around election sites.
Thank you very much. And our next, Chuck Carpenter, former representative from Washington County.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, represent about 500 manufactured home communities in the state of Oregon. We are not opposed to the concept here of political expression in manufactured home communities, and realizing that Representative Edwards was going to be introducing this bill, we did bring this issue up in the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and that most of his concepts have been incorporated into Senate Bill 772. So at this point, I think the consensus in the coalition is that there's no need to go further with this bill, since most of the concepts have been incorporated into Senate Bill 772.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Norton Cabell. I'm the legislative director for Oregon Rental Housing Association, which is a landlord trade group representing 5,000 landlords around the state, only a small number of which are park landlords and managers. And I fully support the concept in House Bill 2639. If I get the number right, sorry. However, we did borrow from Representative Edwards' bill and included in the omnibus landlord-tenant bill that has been carefully negotiated by landlords and tenants over the last 6 or 8 months. The wording is slightly different, and there would actually be some conflict if both bills got approved. So I would appreciate your not passing this bill, but his concept and desire will be fully honored in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Chair, I'll just comment.
Yeah, Representative.
And I appreciate all of you folks for getting that into Senate Bill 772. I have to claim my own lack of diligence. I have not communicated with the Senate chair that has Senate Bill 772, so I don't know what the status of that is and whether it's moving or not, and that's on me to go get that figured out here soon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is that bill is up for a work session next Wednesday, and all anticipation is that we should be able to move that bill through through the process and to a successful conclusion.
Okay. Any further questions for this group? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We're going to close our work session on House Bill 2639, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3084.
Work session or public hearing?
Public hearing, thank you. Close the public hearing, and we're going to open a public hearing on 3084, and thank you, because I'm not ready to work it yet. Well, here is a short explanation.
You vice chairs are really on your game.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 3084 requires the landlord of four or more dwelling units or of a facility to supply voter registration cards to each new tenant who is 18 years of age or older with a written rental agreement or for oral agreements on the first day of occupancy, directs the Secretary of State to distribute voter registration cards to landlords for this purpose.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state representative in House District 14 in West Eugene, Junction City. I bring you this bill out of personal experience and a suggestion from he's not a constituent of mine, but a fella I know in Eugene that is an apartment owner himself. When I was campaigning and walking door to door and whatnot in 2006, I noticed how unreliable the voter registration lists were in apartment complexes. And upon further investigation, I realized that because it is a less permanent housing situation, and in so many apartments there is such quick turnover in the spaces that this is a population of people that is underrepresented
in the voter rolls. And so it wasn't until, I didn't think really about doing anything about that legislatively until a fellow I know in Eugene came to me with this idea, and he said, well, Chris, I'm an apartment owner, and I've always wondered why when I'm signing folks up to live in the apartment that I own and manage, why I don't have to distribute a voter registration card for them, whether they're newly registered voters or just update the address. And I got to thinking about it, and I thought, I don't know why you don't have to do that. And I can certainly see that there would be some concerns about putting another requirement, but as long as we're not requiring the apartment owners or rental property owners to collect the information back and turn it in, but they're simply distributing the voter registration card, then maybe that would be a good way to increase the percentage of folks in that population that are registered to vote. And so I have proceeded with the idea. This bill requires landlords of four or more dwelling units. The number four was picked because legislative council told us that was consistent with other areas in the law that require distribution of certain pieces of information if you're the landlord of four or more units. So that, it seemed to be a logical place to draw the line. There's nothing really more magical than that. I am not interested in putting this requirement on somebody that really doesn't have a significant investment I shouldn't say a significant investment because even one unit is a significant investment, but somebody that doesn't do this often, I'm not looking to put this on to them. If you own a house and you move across town and then you decide to continue renting out your house and you're not really you don't do this professionally per se, then I'm not looking to include those type of folks in the requirement. But if you have a portfolio of properties or a professional property manager, then those are the type of folks that I'm looking at putting this requirement on to help increase the voter registration numbers of renters. So that's the basic concept, and I certainly entertain any questions.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. Representative Edwards, is there anything that prevents your friend from doing this on his own now?
Not to my knowledge, Representative.
Did he volunteer that he would be willing to do this now?
I do believe he would be willing to do it.
Did you discuss the implications of making it statutory and required with him and how that might change the dynamic about how he feels about it?
Representative Roblin, Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, this isn't about him. This is about his renters. And so, maybe he wouldn't appreciate having that put on, but I would argue it's not about him.
And Mr. Chair, thank you for indulging me. I think that you're right. It is about his renters, but I guess I'm pretty sensitive here to one more mandate that has nothing to do with his main job, which is either managing or whatever his situation and others' situation with regard to property management. I'm a little uncomfortable with this kind of civics lesson at the rental office. And I would also suggest to you that online registration might make a huge difference here. It's a real step in the right direction.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I agree. When I drafted this bill, we hadn't contemplated the online registration aspect. I have thought about that as sort of a halfway point. I will note that when my experience with this population of folks is that on average probably have less money and are less likely to have internet access, although that is certainly increasing over time, and whether at one's place of work or at one's home. So I have concerns as well, but not enough to keep me from drafting the bill.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, not so much
Nolan.
A question, but I appreciate the issues that Representative Berger has raised, but if you weigh in the balance the value of an active and engaged citizenry against the inconvenience of stocking a few pieces of paper and handing them out, that's essentially the question that the bill calls, which weighs more importantly.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I would like to emphasize that this does not require a landlord to collect the voter registration card back and deliver it to either the Secretary of State or the County Clerk's office. It is simply distribution of the card, and that's it.
Okay.
At a time when many other documents are being signed and distributed. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we'll have Norton Campbell, Chuck Carpenter, and Dan Meek.
Chairman Roblin, members of the committee, my name again is Norton Cabell. I'm the legislative director for Oregon Rental Housing Association and landlord trade group representing 5,000 landlords around the state of Oregon. I'm also authorized to speak for, on behalf of Metro Multifamily Housing Association. We're trying to be efficient about the use of our time and your time, both, whose owners, members represent some 150,000 rental units, mostly in the metro area. I have to be honest and tell you that I would quickly be out of a job if I ever supported a bill that imposed a burden on landlords without offering anything in return. And yet, who can argue with the goal of increasing voter registration? But my job security aside, I'm here on behalf of those associations to ask you to oppose this bill, and I do that for two reasons. First, as Representative Berger pointed out, it's unfair to impose on a particular industry, and one comprised mostly of private businesses, the burden and cost of furthering social goals unrelated to that industry. And this bill won't even do that particularly well, since only about half of Oregon households rent. We would do better, I believe, to ask Verizon, Cricket, and all the cell phone companies to distribute registration cards with monthly bills, since two-thirds of Oregonians have cell phones. Better yet, ask the gas stations to pass out registration cards, since some 90% of households own a car. Or since virtually everyone has electricity, ask the utilities to provide registration cards that would ensure the most almost all Oregonians get them. And having utilities do this would actually be a whole lot simpler. This bill requires the Secretary of State to distribute registration cards to landlords. There is no list of landlords in the state, so the Secretary would be faced with a daunting task. I estimate there are about 40,000 landlords in the state. Ease of getting into the rental industry is such that landlords really do come and go, and so the burden of maintaining such a list would also be quite cumbersome, far different from the cell phone, gas station, and utility industries. Secondly, while the goal is to increase the percentage of Oregonians who are registered to vote, a goal I do really personally support, I submit from personal experience it won't work. During September and October preceding the 2004 and the 2006 elections, certainly a time when voting is closer to top of mind, my wife and I took registration forms and visited about three dozen of our tenants, asking them to register to vote if they weren't. As an aside, the election office in Eugene was very difficult about this, requiring me to fill out paperwork and provide ID before they would give me a stack of 50 registration forms. And we had a good number of tenants who are not registered to vote. Not a one was willing to take the time to fill out a card and register to vote. So we didn't even bother in 2008, given that lack of response. And this bill is not going to improve that. The property management business is subject to a lot of law. In fact, the Oregon Residential Landlord Tenant Act contains more words than John Steinbeck's Of Mice or Men, of Mice and Men, or Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea. As a consequence, professional landlords are careful to the point of being profligate with their documentation. I've attached to my testimony the paperwork that I go through at lease signing time with a tenant. This is 17 separate forms, notices, or agreements, a blizzard of paperwork. Most of it gets signed without any real comprehension by the tenant, and most tenants throw away their copies within a couple of days. An extra form, no matter how important or noteworthy, is unlikely to survive. So while I support the goal of HB 3084, the mechanism will be expensive, cumbersome, unfair, and ineffective. I urge you to vote against this bill.
Thank you. Question? Well, we'll go through the whole panel first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We second Norton's testimony here. And in particular with manufactured housing, when a resident comes in and moves into their new home, the state already requires, as Norton cited here, large amounts of paper. In the case of manufactured housing, there's the rental agreement, which is 8 pages long. There's the statement of policy, it's 7 pages long. There's a straight talk about manufactured housing, living in a manufactured housing community. There is the 5 years rental history that we're required to give them, and just the simple excitement and confusion of them moving into a new home. So I think adding one more piece of paper to that blizzard of paperwork, as Norton described, is going to be a waste of time and money and resources. And although I applaud the desire to have as many people registered as possible, I don't think this is the vehicle or time to be doing it. So, obviously, we were no vote on this bill.
Stereo. My name is Dan Meek. In addition to representing groups that use the initiative process, I also represent folks who use the election process in general, and actually getting people to sign voter registration cards is rather similar to getting them to sign initiative petitions. It's amazing to me how many voters, new voters, are signed up during quite brief voter registration drives. Hundreds of thousands of new voters can be signed up over a period of just a few months. And as you heard when you considered the electronic voter registration system, it would be better if voters did not have to depend upon meeting a stranger on the street or a stranger who comes to the door asking for their personal information and a signature. Could be an identity thief. It would be better if folks were not dependent upon that kind of system in order to register to vote. People, I think, want to register to vote if given a convenient opportunity to do so. I've gone out and actually checked post offices. Voter registration cards are supposed to be available in post offices, and most of them they are not, actually. Someone ought to follow that up. But, of course, there's nothing you can do to force the post office to keep voter registration cards available. It was suggested that you might as well send out voter registration cards with phone bills. Obviously, most of those cards would be wasted because most people who get phone bills already are registered to vote. A majority of people are registered to vote. What's different about this proposal, and of course I do want to be able to say that I supported more than one bill sponsored by Representative Edwards, what's uniquely well designed about this proposal is that it presents the voter with a registration card at exactly the right time. That is when someone is changing residence. If you change your residence in Oregon and do not re-register, your existing registration is placed immediately upon anyone learning that you've moved. Your registration is placed in inactive status. At that time, any signature on a petition of any sort, initiative, referendum, anything, all invalid, because you're an inactive registered voter, and our Secretary of State has decided that what Oregon law means when it says registered voter, it doesn't mean inactive registered voter. That was a change that was made in about 2002 and adds about some considerable 5% or more to the tally of disqualified signatures on every initiative petition now. In addition, you can, if you are placed in inactive status, you can't vote in the next election unless you get down to the, unless you get down to your county election office and or mail in a new voter registration card or update your information. So most folks don't realize that simply by moving, you lose your status as a legitimate registered voter in Oregon. And everything that you do at that point, whether you try to vote or you try to sign a petition, is invalid. And I would say nearly everyone who signs a petition and is an inactive registered voter doesn't know it. So this is exactly the right time to give the voter this card, and also I would say give the voter an additional piece of paper prepared by the Secretary of State that says if you're moving, and I think people who are renting new apartments, it's probably pretty universal, they're moving. If you're moving, even if you have registered to vote, your registration is now not valid until you fill out this card with your new current address, with this new address. I think I wouldn't know that unless I had a lot of experience on this. I wouldn't know that you immediately need to register to vote again when you move. And as far as going to your county election office and getting ID cards, they gave me as many as I asked for. So I think this is actually an excellent idea.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
One editorial comment, and I appreciate all of your testimony and where you're coming from. I would argue, to Norton's comment, the landlords come and go, and we don't have a central registry, and I completely understand that. I don't know that landlords of four or more units come and go. I mean, I am looking at putting this with people that do this in a professional to semi-professional aspect and kind of know the system, and it would be up to them to distribute the cards.
So, Representative Edwards, members of the committee, I don't have a specific answer to that question, but of our 5,000 members, two-thirds of our members own six or fewer units, and there are a lot of those that own four, five, six. Of course, there are a lot of people that just own a rental home or a duplex, but there are a lot of those small landlords who only own a handful of properties and yet are above this.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, anecdotally, is it your experience that most of these landlords do their own property management, or do they hire professional property managers?
Representative Edwards and members of the committee, in my experience, there are only a handful of property management companies in Oregon that specialize in renting single-family homes. There are a few, but there aren't very many. And again, in my experience, which is anecdotal, although not without some experience, most small property owners, those with fewer than 10 units, manage for themselves. It's not usually cost-effective unless you live out of state to hire that to a property management company. Property management companies really don't care for those really small plexes or a pile of duplexes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Well, thank you all. We will close our hearing on House Bill 3084, and we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 3240.
We're getting a short report.
Our administrator, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3240 requires the expense of any postage for ballots returned by mail that exceeds the expense of postage for mail that weighs 1 ounce or less to be apportioned between the Secretary of State and the county as a cost of election. It requires the Secretary of State to designate by rule a formula for the apportionment of the expense of such postage. Oregon is a vote by mail state, although ballots may be deposited in one of the official ballot drop sites. If ballot is mailed back, postage is required. The amount of postage required by the U.S. Post Office is based on weight and size of envelopes. Sometimes the length of the ballot increases the overall weight of a return ballot envelope to the point that it will require more than a standard single stamp. Not including sufficient postage may result in the ballot being returned to the elector for insufficient postage. In that case, an elector's ballot will not be counted until it is returned to the elector, unless it is returned to the elector early enough to allow remailing with proper postage or delivery to a ballot drop site.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Edwards, House District 14. I bring you this this bill. Let me give you a little bit of history about why I'm bringing you this bill. I sat last legislative session on the General Government Subcommittee of Ways and Means. That subcommittee hears the Secretary of State's budget, along with many other of the executive branch. And we had a discussion in 2007 about what the state was going to do if some of our timber-dependent counties faced dissolution. What were the constitutional requirements? And regardless, and there were certainly, there was a lot of discussion on the committee that regardless of what the constitutional requirements may or may not be, certainly the state would step up and fund the elections, because we just couldn't imagine on the subcommittee a situation whereby, because the county no longer existed or the functions of the county weren't funded, the people weren't able to vote. I mean, I have a hard time imagining that the state would not step up in that instance. So fast forward to the 2008 election this last November, due to the number of local elections, state ballot measures, and, of course, all the way up to the presidential election, the size of the ballot in Lane County went a little bit larger than usual. That created a situation in which it appeared as though ballots were going to weigh more than an ounce and require more than first-class postage. So, come to find out, some ballots did and some ballots didn't. I mean, it was right, they were right on the breaking point, and I talked with folks that literally took their ballot, put it on a postal scale, and it said that it was more than an ounce, took it off, reset it, put it back on, and it said that it was fine. So there was some question about whether or not it was going to be require a 42-cent first-class stamp or a 50, I believe, and I'm sure they'll correct me if I'm wrong, a 58 cents in postage, if I remember right, something like that. And because there was this lack of certainty, the county had printed on the ballot that extra postage was required. If you voted a number of times, you probably read the directions, but maybe you kind of skim and you fill it out because you know how to fill out the ballot, and you put it in the envelope and you mail it away. There were questions about whether or not people were putting enough postage on their return envelopes, and if one stamp was indeed going to be sent on through by the post office or not. So word got out, and if I remember right, the county, and I'm sure they'll correct me when they come up if I'm not exactly right, but the county told folks to be sure to put sufficient postage on via the media, and they kind of started getting the word out. Well, then there were all these people that had mailed their ballots already. They were saying, well, wait a minute, I only put one stamp on it. Did my ballot go through or not? Is it going to be counted? Now, I don't have to tell you on the dais that this was a big election one way or the other this last session, and folks from the left to the right and in the middle just wanted to make sure that their ballot was counted. So, in fact, at one point, because there was a question about whether or not the county was going to pay the postage, and there was a question about whether or not the post office was going to charge them for the postage in the first place, or whether they were just going to send the ballot on through
and not ask for more postage due. There were, because there were all these questions, folks were really rightfully bent out of shape and concerned that their vote was going to count. So I started working with folks locally, and frankly, I offered to raise a fund to lead a fundraising campaign to raise money from anonymous donors into a bank account, so it would be so there would be no funny business or perception that anybody was trying to buy votes, but simply to get the money to the county that they would need to make sure that the election was fair. I was absolutely swamped with emails from folks offering to pitch in and wondering where they could send their $5 or $10 to make sure that the county elections went forward smoothly and that nobody's ballot was returned that had a first-class stamp on it as they thought that they were responsible for. So this opened up a much larger discussion about the state's responsibility in the role of funding elections and funding the postage of ballots. After the election, I got together with the local county commissioner, Annette Newingham from Lane County Elections, and the government relations folks, and from that is what I bring to you today, this bill. This would require that the cost of postage that exceeds an ounce be apportioned between the Secretary of State and the county. In this area of law, I've noticed that they refer to it as the Secretary of State is a proxy for the state. So, I mean, we're talking about postage sharing between the state and the counties. Obviously, this has a fiscal. I didn't realize at the time that I was drafting this bill how difficult bills were going to be that had a fiscal. That was before we were facing a $3.3 billion shortfall. However, I would argue that the counties are also in a world of hurt. And I would argue that we have an obligation to fund elections first. There aren't many things that we do as a democracy that are more fundamental than the vote and the right to vote and make sure that vote is counted in a fair in a fair system. So this bill would require that the Secretary of State establish by rule a formula that would apportion the costs for the postage between the for statewide measures and statewide offices. And so you see on page 4 of the bill, line 10, there's a list of offices that this would include. It would not include the federal offices. It would include the governor, secretary of state, state treasurer, attorney general, commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, superintendent of public instruction, judge, state senator, state representative. District attorney was in there. I'm not sure how district attorney got in there. I'd be open to discussion on many aspects of the bill, including potentially amending the list. So those are the basics of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you. Representative Edwards, I like how you've been thinking about these things, and I share your sincere concern here because in my counties, and this is sort of where I'm going on this, we have, in the city of Salem, we have voter annexations, and like this last time, we had 30 annexations, and what filled our ballot was the city issue, and it cuts across two counties because my city is in two different counties, and there was great fear about those being sent back, and so I share your concern here, But I'm also concerned that the solution doesn't fit the problem exactly, because I'm not sure how... I mean, if I send in my ballot and it's big because my city has a problem with these endless lists, of which, by the way, we got lots of complaints on, because people would say, you know, ballots are complicated enough, and here you have this whole other sheet that has a whole bunch of things on it, but that's another story. So if I send in my ballot, it's the post office that decides I haven't put enough postage on it, so does my ballot then go, and it's good, and the post office bills the county or the Secretary of State or somebody because it was overweight? And does my city get a free pass because they're the problem? You understand? I'm not sure the mechanics of this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it is my understanding, and I'm not an expert on this, but it's my understanding that the post office, and I hope I get this right, but the post office will pass the ballot on through unless there's a certain number that have come from one source, at which point, so one, in this case an elector, but one person sends X number of pieces of mail through. If it's above a certain number, and I can't remember exactly what that number is, they return it to the sender for insufficient postage. If it is fewer than that number, they have the option to send it on through postage due to the recipient. And in at least in this case, I am unclear, and I don't know, I'm unclear how much postage was eventually charged to the county and how much postage was not charged to the county, either because the envelope that was thought to require 58 cents actually only required 42 cents, or because perhaps folks at the post office looked the other way because of the importance of the mail. I don't know, and I don't think that there is an official word on that, and that was one of my concerns, is that there was just, while at the end of the day, to my knowledge, every single ballot in our case went through, and every single ballot was counted. It wasn't, there were questions.
I've seen this, but.
And I don't want questions hanging over any sort of election. So there were, and the cost issue came up, and the cost sharing issue came up because the county commission had to decide whether or not to cover the cost of the postage. And I think that there were fears by some that if they said, send it on through, we'll pick up the tab, that they would be left with an enormous bill. And so I'm not sure that I addressed every aspect of your question, but...
You're getting at the substance of my question, which is, this is harder than it seems, and when you throw the cities into the mix, and which is the one that I'm real aware of, it gets harder. So, but I appreciate you bringing this forward because it is an issue. And as ballots get longer, it's going to be more of an issue. I wish there was some way we could look to printing ballots on lighter paper, or, you know, because that's one of it, too. I noticed that I used to be a printer, and I'm aware that you pay a lot more, but then the paper is more fragile, and there's other solutions out there that I think we ought to think about. But it is an issue.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll start with Annette Newingham, Jan Coleman, Cappy Eaton. Thank you.
I'm Annette Newingham.
Yep.
I'm the notorious Annette Newingham from Lane County.
I didn't say notorious.
No, I know you didn't. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I think Representative Edwards explained it really pretty well. I'll try to just sort of zero in on a couple of issues. This can happen to any county. There are some systems that have heavier paper than other paper, but lengthy ballots at the general seem to be the mode these days, and especially since the state and the cities don't pay their apportion costs, that's the time to put everything on the ballot. And so they are pretty lengthy, which adds to that risk. I think that we'll see this again. This is a problem that occurs in other states as well with lengthy ballots and the postage. We do need to require that voters pay the first class postage for the first ounce. And I do recommend that there be a process where the additional postage somehow, right now there's no statutory authority that says we can even pay for it. It's all kind of quiet and it's all kind of taken care of, and we notify the post office whether to deliver it or not with insufficient postage. So we have to tell the post office all the time. It's very political because the post office doesn't want to get in the front page newspaper for turning the ballot back. We didn't have any ballots that really went back to the voters. But because there's no process that allows us to say, go ahead and deliver it, we'll take care of the difference in postage, then you can't really talk about it because there's no real statutory authority, and then the voters feel insecure about this issue, and rightfully so. I really think that it does need to be addressed to be able to take care of it, and ultimately all the districts, cities, state, county should pay their apportion costs for the elections, all elections. Because then all that extra cost, if it was over an ounce, would be taken care of proportionally by everybody, and that would be the right thing to do. If some cities have 35 annexations, they may decide they want to change and not do it that way, or they want to pay for it. It's, I think, more fiscally sound. But that's my thoughts on this. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Jan Coleman for the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I was the former Yamhill County Clerk. I came from a county who replaced a system very similar to Annette's, and we used to have the same problem. If someone sent back their ballot and included the secrecy envelope, they had to pay extra postage. If they did not include the secrecy envelope, they got by for one stamp. You really don't want to advertise that to people. Anyway, we had the same problem. We would print on both the front and backs of the ballots how much it cost to send them back, but we still had this problem. So I sympathize totally and faced the same problems as Annette did. We do have a solution, however. The bill 3240 does provide towards the end of the bill that involving the state and paying their fair portion of an election. Actually, we're proposing that we think all people who participate in the election should pay their fair share. And so just kind of a hint at a solution here is what we've passed out to you, that this bill could be amended to include everyone. We've also given to you a little color-coded piece of the ballot, you might say. These are all color-coded for you to represent basically the real estate on the ballot that's taken up by the different divisions, the state,
the county,
the cities. Incidentally, the city of Salem had 35 annexations on the ballot, and they could have had 70, but they decided to be nice and only put half of them on that ballot. So, you know, we're talking here proportion people need to be paying. But we thought by giving you this and the color coding, you could see the differences. Right, and the very small portion that the county actually has on the ballot and the county is paying.
Thank you very much.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cappy Eaton, the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I'm here to support the county clerks today. Citizen access to the ballot is extremely important in the election process, and we do and have always supported the vote-by-mail system. That being said, obviously as ballots get bigger with additional measures and additional candidates, postage does increase. And we have, while we didn't have an opportunity to advocate for it earlier, the League has supported the fact that elections should be supported by the entities that have part of the ballot. And that would include the state, counties, cities, school districts, whatever entities do have a piece of the ballot, then they should have an appropriate part in the expense of the ballot. We do believe, however, on the other side, that there are many drop boxes, and there's the ability to go to the county elections office to turn your ballot in. But that is not an option, as we have learned from the younger voters. They really don't want to bother with it. They want to vote by electronically. We haven't gotten to that stage yet. But certainly what happened in Lane County was, I guess, an anomaly of what often happens, because we haven't in the past had so many ballots around the state that cost more than 1 cent or the one ounce. So we do believe that this is the time to start looking at paying for elections to be mailed, because that's our system, by all of the entities that are involved. We also recognize that right now there may not be funds available for either the state or the other entities to put money into this system. And so while we support 3240, we also feel that it may not be possible to do that right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative Garrard. I'm concerned that you were...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any of you ladies may respond. I'm not quite sure that I buy the argument that because a city puts 35 issues on the ballot, they're responsible for the county clerk making an error and sending out a letter that's too heavy for the postage. That's a dotted line to me. I don't see the solid connection.
Chair Roblin and Representative Garrard, there was no error. There was no error that occurred at our general election. The ballot weighed over an ounce. When we took it and we weighed it, it was over an ounce. It required additional postage. That was in the instructions. That was in an insert. It was on the ballot, actually printed on every ballot that everybody received. Plus, I did a press release to let everybody know. It's just that there are different things that can occur. Like, for instance, you might even have something where a ballot in another county weighs just a regular 1 ounce, but they insert something else inside of it. And they sometimes will take it to the post office and say, okay, I want to make sure it gets back in time, you know, and so they have it weighed and they go, oh, it's over an ounce.
I'm sorry, but who is
so
they?
When the voter takes their ballot, sometimes they'll take it into the post office and they'll weigh it, and then they find out it weighs more. And so they get upset about any time it goes over an ounce. But it's not always within our control what they put into the ballot when they're returning it. And sometimes they include additional materials. Sometimes they write notes to us. They sometimes stuff the secrecy envelope or don't, or they sometimes will put portions of voters' material, other information. We get all kinds of things when you go across. But there was no error that occurred in Lane County. I do want to make that really clear. It was just the process of elections, and it happened to Ben. We had a longer ballot this time.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yes.
So what would your observation be on the situation that happened in Eugene?
That is the...
I am from Eugene. County clerk from Eugene.
I'm sorry. I was thinking you were from Lake.
I'm from Lane County in Eugene.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. I withdraw my question.
Okay. So really the issue wasn't that anybody did anything wrong. It was the fact that it cost more than the people were expecting to pay, and they were upset that in order to vote they were going to have to pay 40 or 50 cents.
There were no ballots that were returned,
I know,
though.
I know.
It was the perception and the fear. It really...
And when they were, and the people who did weigh them, a few of them found it was more, and they put more stamps on it. I mean, some did. Yeah.
They did.
Yeah, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did want to emphasize that all the ballots did go through, and while the initial weighing process revealed that it would was over an ounce, I, in fact, talked with somebody that works for the postal system who took his ballot, and he lives in my neighborhood, so he had the same number of things to vote for. He took his ballot to work, used an official post office scale, and he's the one that set it on the scale, weighed it, and it did require more postage, and then reset, and then weighed it again, and then it didn't. So apparently, I mean, it was close, and certainly, in my judgment, it was the right thing for our clerk to say, hey, you need to put more postage on it than just a first-class stamp. I would argue that while the clerk did a lot to advertise and get that word out, this voter never saw it. But I felt it, and I thought, this kind of feels like a substantive, after it was all, you know, sealed up and everything, I felt this feels pretty substantive, so I just double-stamped it. Knew I'd be safe then and sent it off. But.
And I guess the other question I'd ask, because I want to be clear on it, and Representative Edwards had told me before, but I think I heard it in your testimony, and that is there is no current statute which would have allowed you to have paid the extra postage if it had actually cost it. So if the federal government said, pay us this money because we're not giving you the ballots until you pay it, you could not have done, you didn't have any authority to do that.
Yeah, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee, that is correct. There's really no statutory authority that allows us, because the discussion did occur in Lane County because we wanted to pay the additional amount. We were looking for the statutory authority, and it says the voter must pay for the postage. I would really encourage that they only are required to pay the first class, and that the difference somehow we would have at least the authority to pay that difference to minimize the confusion to the voters, because it would have been my choice to not do that. It was very difficult in our county, and we tried not to have the confusion, but because of that, that was an issue.
Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Next we have Alex Kyler, Barry Pack, and Mike MacArthur.
I still think the clerk made a mistake by mailing them out in the first place.
It was told by the jurisdiction.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. I am Alex Kyler. For the record, I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager at Lane County. Really not too much more to add here, other than I did want to, on the record, thank Representative Edwards for helping us bring this measure forward. And there has been a lot of discussion here about the costs of elections. And one thing that you'll see in the bill that follows is we are also doing some work to try to reduce the costs of elections. So we're very aware of trying to make the system more efficient at the same time that we're asking that there are some additional costs covered here. And in the discussion also, it does appear to me that this bill may need that statutory authority for the charging. If we may need to actually get that done for this, much as we state already that there is the vehicle to share those costs, we didn't necessarily hit the statutory authority to cover those costs. The note that I also wanted to bring to the attention of the committee is that this is very much one of the pieces that was discussed in the Federal Forest Payment Task Force that was convened during the interim, and that's why I asked Mike MacArthur from Association of Oregon Counties to come today. And I'd note that apparently when Mike used to testify, he'd say that he was from the...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties, to dramatize the relationship of counties to the state and as a deliverer of services, I used to introduce myself as the administrator of the State Department of County Services, Sherman County Branch.
So I might use the Lane County Branch in the future just to... Thank you.
Well, yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Barry wants to say something.
Totally. Mr. Chair, Mike MacArthur again. a little over 8 months ago... counties were facing a fiscal oblivion that were is a much greater magnitude than what the state faced now. Counties were actively contemplating not being able to function. The governor convened a Federal Forest Payments and County Services Task Force, and I was pleased to serve there with Chair Roblin. We worked for nearly a year on the problems that we were facing. We had a committee that looked at the fiscal distress issues and how counties were going to continue to deliver services. Eventually, we came forward with 53 recommendations. In this bill, 3042, is recommendation number 38, and that's the proportional sharing of costs of elections. The fiscal distress subcommittee talked to counties about would they be able to deliver elections, and the counties all said they would be able to deliver it elections because that was such a primary function of county government. However, at what cost? At what cost to other services in the county? So as a matter of fairness, the notion of a proportional sharing between the state and the counties was discussed by the task force with the state members, and it was agreed to that the state should pick up proportional costs of primary and general election that were borne by those state issues on the ballot. So that portion of the bill, which deals with the proportionate cost sharing, came from the Federal Forest Payments Task Force and is recommendation number 38.
Mr. Pack.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Barry Pack, Secretary of State, Deputy Secretary of State. A number of points have already been covered that I was going to cover, so I'll try and skip through them and save some time. I think that the apportionment of costs of postage in an election is a reasonable policy to be discussed, and certainly one that we would not oppose, assuming the emergency board appropriated money to the Secretary of State to pay the state's share of those costs. And I appreciate Representative Edwards' clarification that in these instances the Secretary of State is a stand-in for the state of Oregon, and it wouldn't necessarily all just come straight out of our budget unless there was an emergency board appropriation. And I was going to, in good humor, pick on the city of Salem with some trepidation, but since the good vice chair already raised the issue, I would point out that the state and the counties don't have any control over the length of the ballot, depending on how many issues get referred to those ballots, and that does affect the length of the ballot and therefore the weight of the ballot. And in the section where we are, the Secretary of State is required to develop a formula to apportion the costs. I would just wanted to point out, and I know the clerks and the counties know this, that typically there are only state offices on the primary and general elections of even-numbered years, and in some cases some special elections in the case of filling a vacancy. In the odd-numbered years, there are no state races, like in the May primary that's facing us in just a month, there are no state offices. So while we haven't had any discussions about what this formula would look like, it's very likely that there would be no cost to the state for these elections, and the counties, as the bill is currently written, would have to continue to shoulder the full cost of that election. When it comes to the primary and general election, however, there is a significant cost to the state, and we have taken a look at the average percentage of the ballot that state offices occupy from 2004 through 2008, and that's 73.5% of primary elections and 60.7% of general election ballots. So we would assume that would be the state's portion of the cost of those elections. And so that could bring the price tag from the primary to the state of anywhere from $1.7 to $2.7 million, and for the general, $2 million to $2.7 million. Those are averages of the last three primary and general elections. So obviously these are costs that are currently being paid for by the county, so if we moved in this direction, those would be savings to the counties, but a cost incurred to the state. And the last thing that I would just like to point out for the committee, since we've been talking a lot about postage, is, as I'm sure you're aware, the postal rates are going up next month in the middle of our election cycle. And we've heard from the United States Postal Service that it is likely that we will see annual increases in postage potentially every May. And so that will continue to pose a problem, and we're working with the county clerks to do some outreach and education to voters to know that they'll either need to buy new stamps or buy the forever stamps and save them for their vote ballots in the future.
Questions of this panel? Representative Berger.
Maybe not a question so much as a comment. Last session when we had what seemed like limitless amounts of money compared to today, there was discussion in this committee, I recall, of if we're going to have vote by mail, why should voters have to pay for any stamp? We should pay for it ourselves. And at the time, I thought that was somewhat laughable, but I think it's less so now. Because what we're doing here, which bothers me, is we're parsing out the cost of the ballot according to who put something on the ballot in such a way. I guess every ballot is different. And as you point out, during certain ballots, the feds have a great big piece. And they certainly, when they have their great big pieces, drive the number of ballots that come back in a significant way, therefore impacting the cost of the county. Sorry, we're not going to be able to charge them. Wish we could. So I guess the road you're marching down is bothering me a little, because what I hear you saying is we're going to parse ballot by ballot that percentage of the ballot that was put there by this local jurisdiction or that local jurisdiction. And I don't know how we're going to get there, gentlemen. Is that really what we're talking about here? A ballot by ballot parsing according to, well, this particular ballot has, where was the thing we were given? Has so many federal, so many state, so many county, and so many city pieces on it, so therefore the postage has to be parsed on those lines. Is that really where we're going here?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, the way that the costs are apportioned now is exactly that model, where those who are not excluded from the general and primary are apportioned costs. And thus, I think the answer to your question is yes, but the degree to which it is unfair currently also exists, where you have certain parties who do have to pay their apportion costs, for instance, school districts, community colleges, and special districts, and they are, in fact, currently have petitioned the Secretary of State to address this due to some inconsistencies. So I think what we're trying to do is to address that issue. I wish there were a better way, and I know that in addition to Representative Edwards, who was extremely concerned about the way it worked out in Lane County, we additionally got a very heated letter from the congressman in the 4th District, also concerned about the elections. And I actually drafted the letter to respond to him And, yeah, we'd very much like to work with the federal government to address. This is a model. Oregon is a model for vote by mail. And if we could have vote by mail to be very successful, which I think it's proven to be in Oregon, to be very successful across the United States, I think it would be beautiful if it were postage paid by the U.S. government.
Well, I guess in answer to this, I think maybe excess postage is the issue. We're and that's our problem. We don't know ballot by ballot how much excess postage there's going to be election by election, and who caused that. I mean, where is the tipping point? Was it that one more piece on the county ballot that made it go overweight, or was it those 35 that should have been 72 City of Salem pieces divided between two counties, I might add? The City of Salem, when you go to apportion, it gets even trickier because one county may have a very small ballot and it doesn't tip the scale, and the other one may have a very large ballot and it does tip the scale within the City of Salem. So maybe, Mr. Pack, in the end, because the state is sort of the elections, states run their own elections, if you will. The state of Oregon is in the end, and the Secretary of State's office is in the end, where the elections buck stops, if you could put it that way. Maybe what we need to get to with regard to postage is any ballot that has this issue, that the county goes back to the county, the state then reimburses the county out of state funds for that postage issue and gets us out of this whose ballot tipped the weight scale or which organizations. Do you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
Which organization's ballot tipped the scales? Just a suggestion.
Representative Nolan?
One could certainly have quite a debate about the theory of who is responsible for elections. Ultimately, the right to vote is something that that belongs to the people, and it isn't the state or the county or the city that is responsible. And from my perspective, it isn't the state's money or the county's money or the city's money. All of those entities derive their funds from the taxpayers, different subsets of taxpayers. And I think it's a legitimate question to think about whether taxpayers in Sherman County, who might have a short ballot, should, through the Secretary of State, subsidize taxpayers in Multnomah County who are initiative happy or have gazillions of elected offices that tip their ballot over the scale. Well, I think it's a legitimate question to ask how that should be appropriately apportioned, and I would never have thought of it on my own.
Yes. I'd like to make one more comment. I just want to be clear that Section 4 of the bill does address additional costs other than postage that go
right
over. There are certain other expenses that are apportioned, and just to be crystal clear
right
on that point, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you all. Dan, Meek? Fairly quickly, Dan, because we have one more bill that we want to at least get a couple people to speak on, so if you can do that, I would appreciate it.
Dan Meek. I'm on an electronic discussion group with the nation's election law professors and practitioners, and I'm surprised that they hold vote by mail generally not in high regard. They see it as simply permanent absentee balloting, but with the state taking away the convenience of local polling places. I think if they knew that a ballot could possibly be rejected for the lack of a few cents of postage, I think vote by mail's credibility would be severely harmed. Five comments. First, in drafting, I as you heard a moment ago, there doesn't appear to be any authority for the clerks to pay for this postage, and this bill doesn't really give them the authority to pay for the postage and certainly doesn't require it. I would say that the clerks should be authorized and required to pay for the postage. Second, the clerk should be required to accept ballots with any first-class stamp on it. For example, I've got lots of 41-cent stamps sitting around. I might just put a 41-cent stamp on it, and this bill would not pay that extra cent. This bill only pays for above the first ounce. It doesn't pay the, it doesn't say that the state, the clerk can accept something where the first ounce is paid for with the wrong amount. And as you heard, postage rates are now going to change quite frequently. So I would say any first class stamp is good enough. Third, I would say that voters should pay nothing for their ballots. This should be something, maybe the state can negotiate a bulk rate with the post office in order to get these, in order to get these delivered and not depend upon someone putting the correct first-class stamp on it, as this bill as written would do. Fourth, I would apply it to all elections. I don't see any reason that some elections your vote should be dependent upon whether you put a 41 or a 42-cent stamp on your ballot. This should be all elections. And finally, I would urge that the clerks and the Secretary of State, please don't use thinner paper in order to reduce the weight. I fill out my ballot and it soaks through to the other side. They're printed two sides, and at some point that might cause a problem with the machine. So please use thick paper, and please negotiate a rate with the post office. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're going to close our hearing on House Bill 3240, and
you want to do this motion?
No, we'll do the motion. And we're going to open a hearing on HJR 36. And just so people know, we probably aren't going to take a lot of testimony. One, this bill will be held over to Monday for the rest of the testimony. But we have a member with us who is unable to be here on Monday, and we wanted to make sure we got his testimony. And so we'll even let him talk before the any explanation.
Oh, okay, great.
We'll give it to you.
Okay. It's complex, so we'll save that for a question. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Bruner, representing House District 37. Thank you. I hate being the last guy on a Friday because I realize where everybody wants to go, including myself. I'm just here carrying the water for Dave Edwards. This is Dave Edwards' bill. I'm just helping him out. I've got some, and because I want to get it right for Dave, I have some written testimony, so I apologize, but I want to make sure I get it right for Dave. So, committee, if men were angels, said James Madison, no government would be necessary. And if those of us elected to partisan office in Oregon were angels, HJR 36 would not be necessary. But despite what we tell our spouses, we are not angels. We are dedicated public servants and lawmakers, and we believe that our party, whichever party that is, provides the best ideas and the best policies for achieving public goals. This is true, I believe, of every lawmaker, every secretary of state, and every governor for the last 150 years. And let me be clear, I'm proud of my political party, and I believe that more often than not, my party provides the best path forward. And my guess is that each of you would say the same thing of your party. Dedication to your party is a noble thing. It is the bread and butter and spice of American democracy. And the inherent competition created by parties creates the marketplace of ideas that best serve the people we represent. But, and let's be honest, parties and partisanship are not objective. And partisanship can be, and too often is, contrary to our collective best interests. Compromise is a sign of strength, not weakness. Yet how often do we fail to compromise in order to serve a partisan interest? There is partisanship in our redistricting process. There always has been. How could it not be? After all, we are all partisans. Partisanship is the redistricting in the redistricting process is structural. Often the citizens of Oregon view us as unnecessarily partisan. Our redistricting process is both a cause and a perpetuator of this view. This, in turn, violates trust and creates cynicism among citizens, making it more difficult for us to address those big issues, especially in difficult times like these. In turn, further perpetuating mistrust and cynicism. It's a political death spiral. Redistricting reform does not cure, but does help this. Oregonians, for the first time ever, would be assured that the process was fair, objective, and free from partisanship. Many other states have recognized this and have implemented commission structures for redistricting. California, to name one, just passed comprehensive reform in 2008, and the list of supporters for that effort in California included the AARP, the League of Women Voters, the NAACP, the ACLU, the California Nurses Association, and countless good government and chambers of commerce advocates across their state. Reform in Oregon will mean that voters choose their representatives, not the other way around. Reform will mean that districts are not artificially drawn, not gerrymandered to the point where representatives are disincentivized to work toward compromise and bipartisanship. Under our current system, Mr. Chair, it is a perverse incentive indeed where a representative who works for compromise is ultimately punished at the ballot box just because of district contortion. Finally, and most importantly, redistricting reform will deliver what most Oregonians say they want most: a legislature that reflects our state's diverse interests, yet at the same time is consciously and electorally motivated to work for the common good. Mr. Chair, I want to finish this by quoting Abraham Lincoln. He once said that we serve our party best by serving our country first. And I think that sage wisdom applies equally to serving Oregon and the people of Oregon. So I thank you for that. And let me just sort of a P.S. on this. I'm highly confident, probably the best way to describe it, highly confident that there's going to be a ballot measure on this issue in the 2010 election. And I think that as one of those legislators who believes that we need to do the work and not pass the work off, I think we can demonstrate real leadership by tackling that issue, the issue of redistricting reform this session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Question, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hesitate to ask a little bit more of a lighthearted question given the heartfelt testimony, but I was just wondering whether you and Representative Edwards collaborated on the quotes you used before.
Getting dead guys?
Yeah.
We actually collaborated on a opinion piece that I think is going to run in the Oregonian tomorrow, and yes, we've got some dead old guys in there. So.
Thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did note, Representative Bruin, that the co-sponsors of the bill are incredibly, an incredibly bipartisan list in almost exact proportion to Republican and Democratic representation in the House.
Can I correct you?
Oh, yeah.
It has a majority Democrats on it.
I know. No, in proportion,
I'm just carrying the water.
We have 60% of the House are Democrats and 40% are Republicans. And I did the math, and 61% of the bill sponsors are Democrats and 38% are Republicans. So.
Any other questions of the House witness? Thank you, and we will be carrying this bill over.
Hopefully you get it.
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In relationship to the quote, I would note that in the history of philosophical thought, there are philosophers of some considered reputation, much more so, I think, than the president, former president, Emil Durkheim, for one, that would take exactly the opposite view, that even if we were angels, we still would have a need for government.
Well said. And I think on Monday, once again, you'll have additional testimony.
Absolutely.
As well as hopefully a description of what the bill does.
Yes.
It does a lot. So,
yeah. We will do that.
Great.
Thank you. So I'm going to close this hearing because on House HGR 36. We are going to carry it over. I also need to open House Bill 3451 because we have some person that came all the way from Klamath County, and I wanted to make sure that before she had to go home, she got a chance to do it. So we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 3451.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This is Linda Smith, our county clerk.
Ah, very
and
good.
And one of the finest in the state.
And so again, we aren't going to do the description, but we're going to let you.
Done now.
Probably. I am Linda Smith, the Klamath County Clerk, and I'm here supporting House Bill 3451. Some of my colleagues, when this is called back up for testimony, will be talking about the how it would benefit large counties, and I want to say that it would benefit medium and small counties also. And I know I just want to make it short. Three key benefits for the medium and small counties. Number one is the reduction in election costs. We're all constantly looking at ways to stretch our funding while maintaining or improving our services to our customers, and this bill would do both. Being able to run the ballots through the tally machine up to 7 days prior to the election would enable many counties to distribute their temporary and permanent workers differently so that some of the permanent staff would be able to, in the week prior to the election, get some of these tasks done that really temporary workers are mostly doing election day because of other requirements that the permanent employees are having to manage on election day. It would also provide more up-to-date results election evening. Because we could process many of the ballots that require extra handling, the problem ballots, the machine kicks out and things, we'd be able to look at those and have those ready for the election evening result report. It would also do one thing that would manage our machine difficulties a little bit better. When the tally machines require maintenance on election evening, which none of us want, the machines are tested and retested for weeks prior to the election, but Murphy's Law sometimes happens, and in elections it tends to happen on election day. So all of the counties are trying to get the vendors at the same time if they need help in their county. The vendors have been very good about placing representatives around the county so that they're not coming 8 hours to a county, but if Klamath County is competing with Multnomah County for a technician, chances are Klamath's trip is going to be put off a little bit. So if we could get some of the ballots run through before election evening and some of those issues would come up, the machines, as I said, are tested and retested and run very well as we start election day, but as you know, your car usually runs before you take it to the mechanic, and as you pull off the lot, something happens. So it would help in those three things. So thank you for taking my testimony and opening the hearing up so that I could do this before I drive home. My granddaughter's doing a report, and I'd hate to have her put nothing happen. So.
Thank you very much. So that was the only person who was over 100 miles, and so that's the deference we gave, and we are going to close the hearing, but we will carry this bill over also to Monday. So with that, we're going to close the hearing on House Bill 3451, and then I have a motion from Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules and allow Representative Gelser to vote on Senate Bill 75A and House Bill 2095 as amended.
So Representative Edwards has moved that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Gelser to vote on Senate Bill 75A and House Bill 2095 as amended. Is there any objection? Seeing none, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 75A, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2095. How do you vote?
Aye.
I and Representative Gelser votes aye on Senate Bill 75A and aye on House Bill 2095. Doesn't change the well. And so I will close hearings on Senate Bill 75A, House Bill 2095. We're trying to work so that next Friday we may have one bill, just a work session. It was a bill we heard, and I can't remember the number right now. Remember the number of the bill? But I'll get to that to you Monday. And we're also talking about maybe having that moved as well. So right now it'll be a very short meeting on Friday next week so people can get back to their homes. 2839. So if you want to look that bill over before you come back, that would be great. And hearing any other, we will adjourn the rules meeting. Thank you all for being here.